Anybody have any questions? Everybody understand it completely and thoroughly? Well, because of the involvement of vitakka and vichara, initial and sustained application of mind. How the heck does Ajahn Jeff translate it?
Evaluation
is the last one. There's something before that. Sustained thought? Applied thought, that's it. Applied thought and evaluation. I think that's that. So that's the use of that applied thought and evaluation. And then second jhana is more the mind is not, it's absorbing more rather than turning and investigating or evaluating. Evaluating is a good way of saying, because it doesn't necessarily mean that one is thinking about it a lot, but one is applying the mind, and you can be looking at the object of meditation in from different angles, and then one seeing where the mind can actually absorb into or delight in. Dennis.
Thinking about the analogy of the accountant.
Yeah.
In that analogy, it seems, you know, that it probably works pretty linearly to train. Then you really probably don't stand any chance of being able to balance your bank statement.
Yes.
You kind of have to master some basic skill, or else the later skill, just forget about it.
Yeah.
I understand with the Dhamma practice, it's not exactly so linear.
Yes.
And then you can, you know, undertake different steps all simultaneously, etc.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering, since you've taught many students, Western students, monks, and lay people, have you noticed that there are any particular, say, what you might call more basic or preliminary practices that really is important to kind of focus on at the beginning? And then similarly, are there any other practices that if you try to start them out at the beginning, like your chances of being able to do those practices are pretty slim, or only maybe the exceptional person would be able to do that?
Yeah, you know, I think the... and again, it's not set in stone, but in terms of a general principle, a modicum of kind of faith and confidence, and not just sort of faith and confidence in the teaching and the Buddha's path or the overall structure. But there's also a kind of a confidence in the fact that, if I put some effort into this, there's going to be a result. That it's not too cynical or hopeless, because we can easily undermine ourselves by both in terms of. Just looking at the Buddha's teachings he's just some other philosopher or something, and then not giving the teachings a fair shot, we think that it's, you know, well, the teachings are fine for him, but they don't really apply to me. So there needs to be that fundamental confidence that needs to be paid attention to and kind of nurtured. and remembered as a and of course the other practices, you know, will feed back into that, but it has to be kind of remembered. Oh yeah, this is really foundations and fundamental to growth. And then you know, in terms of practices that you know, some people can pick up the teachings in an intellectual way, and then sort of like, you know, it's all about letting go and non-discrimination and non-dual nature of reality and blah blah blah, and which may be true enough, but you know, the foundation isn't there, so that the real kind of stability and equanimity and clarity to actually let go is not there. So that's a drawback sometimes. Just because you can conceive of it intellectually, it doesn't mean that's actually all that realizable. It's like wishful thinking. It's like, I remember Ajahn Chah, there was a monk who came to Ajahn Chah's monastery, and you know, part of being at Ajahn Chah's monastery is following the Vinaya, the monk's rules of discipline. One of the monk's rules of discipline is not to have money, and he came and sort of said, well, you know, I'm carrying money, and I want to stay here. And well, I'm not attached to it though. And then they can I still stay here? And Ajahn Chah sort of said, well, yeah, if you can, you know, if you can eat a cup of salt and say it's not salty, then yeah, okay, you can stay. You know, so that you know, sort of it's okay to talk about it, but you know, real relinquishment comes from and kind of letting go, non-clinging, you know, comes from you know, kind of a real stability of mind, clarity. So those are two ends of the path that you know, both need that gradual support. Yes, Laura.
I'm not sure I got this right, but was it something about using the body in states of bliss or really extreme well-being?
Yes.
And then,
that's a good way of putting it, extreme well-being.
Mm-hmm. But I've been in states like that, and in those states, my body seems to disappear.
Yes, I mean, to a certain degree, but I think it's important that
the awareness.
Yeah, there's a you know, to a certain degree, but it's not disembodied. I think that's the aspect that. Is helpful for this progression, that one isn't, you know, there are definitely times when, you know, the mind becomes very peaceful, very clear, very blissful, and, you know, the body, one doesn't seem to experience the body because of the overwhelming nature of the emotional or mental experience. But in terms of this gradual path, that there is a kind of an anchoring of that experience, so that it doesn't become disembodied and therefore kind of disjointed, and that's an important part of that cultivation of, because it isn't so much the experience of extreme well-being that is the goal. It's the ability to gain clarity and stability so that one can see through the experience as something that is uncertain or impermanent, as a changing nature, which the mind oftentimes doesn't is it wants to disregard that, and then also the tendency to so that identification of self with experience on a refined mental level, it's tempered by the body experience. So then that it helps one to be able to relinquish and let go and not identify with a mental event that sometimes doesn't have a reference point. So that's in terms of a tool, it's very, very helpful.
Are you saying that you can get attached, become attached to these states?
Oh, totally. Wow, wait, this is better to attach to than most other things. You know, in terms of logic. But it's very helpful. Yeah. It's very helpful. Yeah. It's a very good reminder. Oh, Meiji Gao. Yeah.
And there was a lot there in her experience that seemed to speak really directly to me.
Oh, good.
And how difficult it was for her to give up her experiences with the astral world.
Yeah.
And the demons and spirits in order to get beyond that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, very much. That again, it gets you back into, because it's so fascinating, and kind of ethereal, and you know, there's a natural kind of delight in that kind of refinement, but then having that reminder of the body is really. Really helpful, really grounding. Dan.
It's maybe a question that's sort of circling around these other questions, but it's related to the simile of the path, the Rajagaha.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just thinking, you know, it's sort of a riff on Dennis's question. Which is like in the case of that simile, it's quite obvious. Like, well, just don't make the wrong turn.
Yeah.
But of course, meditation practice is a bit.
It's a bit more subtle than that. Yeah, a bit more subtle than that. Yeah.
So I guess the question would be, like, could you thinking maybe in terms of like an example of like a classic beginner's mistake, maybe. A classic mistake of someone who's had some experience with it, and then the mistake of someone maybe who's classic, more advanced practitioner's mistake in that. What is the long turns? Assuming the sincerity, we're talking about a person who's
actually making mistakes. Well, just this is one. Think when we were talking about this theme, like I love the theme and it was really appealing to me, but I also shared with Ajahn Pasno my somewhat, I'm not sure what the word is, hesitation, because there's another side to this which we're not talking about, and that's what about the fact that about somebody who's like they've come across the Dhamma, they've heard the Dhamma, they've tried practicing it, they've been at it for 20 years, and they're still kind of not getting anywhere. And so then what happens? Because then I would say one classic mistake that sometimes people can happen in all spiritual practices is they put too much faith in one how can I say this? They're putting their faith in the wrong place. And you have to be constantly coming back to what is it you're going to put your faith into. Because, you know, eventually your teacher is going to abandon, like, he's going to leave you. He's going to die. She's going to die. Eventually, the monk that you are so inspired by is going to disrobe. Eventually, you're going to realize that, you know, the book you've been reading wasn't the Buddha's word after all. Okay? And it's like, there you've been practicing 20 years with complete faith in this, and then it turns out that for some reason your faith is gone. So that's the classic beginner's mistake, in the sense that this doesn't surface, I think, for many, many years. And then suddenly you hit a point where it's like, well, geez, you know, is this really working or not? And that's where you have to, you kind of go to another level. In a certain sense, this is where your spiritual practice begins, because you're kind of forced to kind of fall back on, you know, the ideas that are in the book. And the book might be totally right, but the ideas that are in the book, or the ideas you're getting from the teacher, like, suddenly the teacher's gone, the ideas don't have meaning the way they did before, and you've got to fall back on a more deeper and more profound faith. And what is that? It's sort of like faith in some kind of, and here I'm just going to really abstract principles, but this is what it comes to, falls back on, is like truth, goodness, generosity, and that pursuit of truth and freedom. So, and basically having faith in that. And I will add, as cerebral as it sounds, with faith in causality. So, like, if you can't have faith, if the causal principle doesn't, like, you might be practicing for years, and I'm not speaking from experience here, but you might be practicing for years and be frustrated that it isn't panning out the way you're expecting. And that's, I would say that's the main mistake that beginners have, is that they expect it to be a certain way, and it never is what you're expecting. You know, you ordain as a monk or a nun, it's not going to be what you're expecting. And so it's almost like, eventually, it's sort of like the Buddhist dark night of the soul. You know, in Christian terms, like, eventually one day you've got so much faith in God, and then one day you realize that God doesn't exist, as it were. And then what do you do? So that's where you're forced to reevaluate your understanding of God. I'm kind of going to a different tradition here, but so in Buddhist terms, it's like you start to come back to kind of more basic principles, that it's like, you know, well, this can't be wrong, because if you can't put your faith in causality, we're all in big trouble, because if you can't trust that effort has result, you know. And it may be that it's not going to pan out the way that you thought. It's not nearly as linear as you thought. It may be that the efforts you put forth today may not surface for lifetimes in terms of the result. But if you don't have faith in that principle of causality, then you're really in trouble. So but you've got to start with your faith somewhere. So you hear it from a teacher, you hear it from a book or whatever, and you start with faith. And then eventually through suffering, sad to say, through suffering, and having everything kind of fall apart on you time and again, you kind of refine your sense as to what it is that's worth trusting in.
The story of the student getting directions of how to get to Rajagaha or Savati, I see this almost every single day in the workshop. I can see, like, a student has a preconceived idea of where they're going on the path. And they'll ask the right questions, but they'll have a preconceived idea. So someone will come up to me in the workshop and say, where are the screwdrivers? And I'll say, it's on that wall. And I'll walk over there and say, it's on your right. They'll look on the left. I'll say, on the middle shelf. And I'll look down at the ground. And I just say, I can see it. And I'm giving them instructions on how to, where it is. But they're looking in a completely wrong area. And then I see it in myself. I'll ask Yannicka, where the drills are. And I'll have a preconceived idea, and I'll start going in that direction, and he'll be, no, it's to the left, and I keep looking to the right. I see it every single day.
It's a bit like that Muslim story. What is it? I can't remember how it goes. Something like something like the key, he's lost his keys. That's it. That's it, yeah. Yeah, you see, so
why are you looking over here? This is where the light is. I dropped it over there.
Yeah, basically that's it. Because it's easier to look where the light is. You're hoping it's going to be under the street lamp, because that's where there's light. Even though you dropped it, 10 feet that direction, you don't want to look there because it's not so pleasant.
Yeah, great. This one, there's a little saying that I've been loving lately. They asked the Zen master, to write, what would he say if he wrote the biography of his life? And he goes, one mistake after another. And another thing that's kind of been percolating in my mind when we talked about the graduate training, and you kind of get close to the middle and you were talking about heaven. It didn't say heavenly realms, it said heaven.
True.
So for me, if I'm taking the word heaven, the word also correlates to haven. So heaven is a haven, it's a place to go. It's
temporary haven.
So you're in a haven, you're a place where everything's safe, it's okay, things are all right there. So if I'm in that place of heaven and I'm okay and I'm safe, and then it's like, oh, this is a place that I can have faith. So it takes me back to the first part of the training. But what is it that gives me faith? And then that leads me to having faith in the Dharma, the Buddha, and the Sangha. And so if I think about it that way, what is that giving me faith in? It's giving me faith in the last part of the graduate training, the Four Noble Truths. So it's like, what does heaven mean? It's a haven that actually can give me faith to oversee the whole practice.
Fair enough.
Yeah, I'd like to ask, in light of these mishaps that we take along the path, at what point would you say, other than that desperate suffering,
right,
would we know to ask, say that we were lost, versus we just haven't gone far enough? And if, what would we ask in light of Ajahn Dhammapala's comments to get out of a preconceived notion when we're hearing the instructions, but still?
Well, that is where suffering is your best teacher, and both in small ways and big ways. So essentially, that is how you refine your practice, and you start kind of learning a sense as to what's working and what doesn't. That's through basically suffering. And that's, so suffering, there's another causal chain which I didn't read, is the Buddha talks about how suffering is the causal condition for the arising of faith. So it's another slightly nice little angle on that. But also, just to put the same thing, but in a slightly more positive spin, because it's been a bit negative in the last few, like a bit dark, but there's just a story Ajahn Jayasaro tells, and this is about the Aikido master. I'm not sure, do you know this one? Where this master is like this complete master with his balance, and he's like a genius, and he never loses his balance. And the student says to the master, you know, you're so inspiring, you've been at this for like 80 years, and you've never lose your balance. And he goes, what are you talking about? That's not true at all. I'm losing my balance all the time. My skill is not in the fact that I never lose my balance, but it's in how quickly I regain it. And so it's okay to be making these mistakes, and it's kind of part of everything. It's just you make them, and then you kind of, as quickly as you can, and a beginner maybe takes a while, maybe it takes a few, you know, a while to get back on the path, but, you know, basically that's the whole thing, is you kind of make a mistake and you get back on it, you make a mistake, you get back on it. Eventually, to an outsider, it looks like you're kind of on it all the time because you're so skillful. Your own experience maybe is actually you're kind of following all the time, but you're immediately getting back on it because you just recognize that's the best thing to do.
So the suffering then in the presentness.
Pardon?
How when things are pleasant, but you're not quite really headed in the right direction, is it?
Well, I mean, that's.
To see that this is suffering.
Well, there's two aspects. One, if you have the mindfulness that can recognize a pleasant state is a pleasant state and not to get attached to it. Okay, so that's one. That's great if you can do that. But that's hard, and that's why they say heaven is very hard place to get enlightened from. Because generally people just hang out, right? So it's a very hard place, not totally impossible, because if you have the mindfulness, you can not get attached to it, to everything, and you can let go. But then, at the end of the day, what we wanted to recognize is, and this is where it is refinement, because the things that we think right now are pleasurable, if seen in the proper light, are actually suffering. The Buddha has that lovely simile of the leper who you know, the only relief he gets from his wounds is by burning them, but then that makes it worse. And the Buddha says he actually thinks he's getting some relief simply because his faculties are deadened and dulled, and therefore he actually experiences pleasure in something that is painful to touch. And he goes, in the same way, we generally, even the things that we experience as blissful, like an eon in heaven, is seen in the proper light. That's actually a very unsatisfactory condition and not worthy of attachment.
So by continuing on the path,
so,
in the noble truths,
yeah,
eventually something will end, the impermanence of that pleasant state.
Yeah,
and through suffering, you can see, this was...
Through... And here's another nice just little thing to keep in mind. This is this time is from the Buddha, not an Aikido master. It's the Buddha says, suppose there was a man who, the king said, okay, take this man and stab him with 100 spears in the morning. And then he's still alive at noon, stab him with 100 spears at noon. And then in the evening, he's still alive, stab him with another 100 spears in the evening. And then tell that man that he'll have that experience every day for the next 100 years. But at the end of that 100 years, he'll realize the Four Noble Truths. Let's say this was a bargain. He goes, well, a wise person would actually, it's nice the way he says this, a wise person would actually consider accepting the bargain. He doesn't say a wise person would do it. But he says, he goes, a wise person would consider this. And why is that? Because samsara is long, and it's a long, treacherous journey. But then he says, I declare, recognition of the Four Noble Truths is not accompanied by pain and suffering, but recognition of the Four Noble Truths is accompanied by happiness and joy. So it's like to clearly see suffering in its fullness is actually a very joyous sort of experience, because you're liberating yourself from that which is truly, truly unsatisfactory.
Okay, one more question.
Can you speak a little bit more about the permanence of goodness?
Sure. Goodness is impermanent. in the same way that everything is impermanent. So the thing is just because it's impermanent doesn't mean that we don't do it. Because, again, looking back at the causal principles, you recognize that the causes that we put into goodness or that which is wholesome lead to well-being and a kind of ease. And that that's very beneficial, both for oneself, and it tends to be beneficial for others. So those aspects of say, like the Buddha talking about, I gave it this morning in the reflection a little bit, where the Buddha talks about the five great gifts, that there's these very great gifts, special gifts, but it's the five precepts, because it's a gift of security and freedom from fear. It's a gift of compassion. So that those are acts of goodness, which are beneficial for oneself and beneficial for others. In the same way, all the different aspects of goodness are something that lay the seeds of stability and well-being. And that's essential for being able to have a clear enough mind to really see through the nature of things. But in the end, it's like Ajahn Chah sort of saying the basis of right view, right understanding, is knowing that this cup's this is a broken glass. Even if it's solid and permanent and seeming right now, but inherent within its nature, is that it has its impermanence. So the same with states of mind, states of being, states of goodness. So that, or even our meditative states, they change. That doesn't mean they're bad or that we don't do it, but it's that you have framing what we do with right understanding. And that's what kind of undermines the causes for or kind of discontent or dis-ease within the mind. That's the dukkha. Because we get the dukkha is more the expectation. When we, or the belief or the hope that it's not going to change or it's not going to turn into something else. Because that's more the problem. Okay? Okay, maybe we can end the day with a sharing of blessings. If we have chanting books, could go around. What page is it on? Now let us chant the verses of sharing and aspiration through the goodness that arises from my practice. May my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of death, may those who are friendly, indifferent, or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life. May they soon attain a threefold bliss and realize the deathless through the goodness that arises from my practice and through this act of sharing. May all desires and attachments quickly cease, and all harmful states of mind, until I realize Nibbana in every kind of birth. May I have an upright mind with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge. Unsurpassed is the protection of the Dhamma. The solitary Buddha is my noble lord. The Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all these, may darkness and delusion be dispelled. Okay. Be well and happy, everybody.
Is it okay?
It's over.